Yeah, all this talk about thinking outside the box, and I think in quantum mechanics we're always told we should only think outside the box, and I want to go back and think inside the box a little bit. This talk is going to be a little bit of a change of pace. It's one of, I gather, two experimental talks at this conference. Don't worry too much, because even if I'm an experimentalist, when I give talks at experimental conferences, people usually think I'm giving a theoretical talk, so hopefully I'm somewhere between the two. I'm actually really pleased to be able to speak at this conference, very grateful to the organizers for having invited me. When I started my PhD, I was deciding between working with Ray Chow and John Clauser, and I remember meeting John at some happy hour or something and telling him I'd actually decided to work with Ray on the problem of the tunneling time. And John immediately looked at me and said, well, that's going to be hopeless. And started my PhD. I said, why is that hopeless? And he said, because you can't even define the word time. And over a few beers, we argued about that for the next hour, and I decided to forget this argument and go ahead and do my experiments. And to finally be at a conference where people are really asking what is time is a great excitement to me. Now, unfortunately, I missed yesterday, so I didn't hear Lev's talk in particular, and I'm probably going to say a lot of things very similar to what he said. Either that or I'll contradict him. Now, I know if I contradict him, he'll jump up and interrupt me, so that's okay. And if I just repeat what he says, I think that's also okay, because usually when I talk about weak measurement, I get the feeling after my talk that I could just start over, give the same talk again, and convey neither any more nor any less information than I had the first time. So we'll see if that works. Since I'm an experimentalist, though, I don't actually do any work. These are the people who actually do the work, and I want to make sure to give them credit. Maybe that's not as common among theorists or philosophers, but in particular, the people who've really worked with me on weak measurement are Kevin Resch, who's now here at IQC, and Jeff Lundin, who's somewhere between Oxford and Barcelona at the moment, which I think means on vacation in Yugoslavia, well, whatever it's called these days, and some of the atomic physics work that I'll at least briefly show you was built up by Anna Jaffrey and Mirko Zirka, and is being continued by Chris Eleanor and Roxin Chang these days. And there are some names of theorists who've participated in a bunch of this stuff, some of which you'll recognize, some of whom are here. And just down the road, that's what we look like, or did the last time I had my camera out. And in summary, I just want to say measurement is not just your father's observable anymore. We don't all sit around talking about projective measurement or even von Neumann's theory of measurement. And to me, as an experimentalist, it's very exciting that even at a practical level, this is true. We're really out there studying different kinds of quantum measurement, POVMs, weak measurement, et cetera, and how they behave in the laboratory, and what they can be used for, what their side effects are, whether they can be used to create new kinds of effective interactions for quantum computing, for instance. And we'll talk about a number of these examples. Won't necessarily get to all of them at this point. The main thing that I want to think about is back to this issue of post-selection. Are we allowed to talk about what goes on behind closed doors? In other words, can I ask what the trajectory of some quantum particle was? Can I ask what its history was? Can I make inferences based on post-selection? And especially, can I make inferences based on the knowledge I have, both from state preparation and from post-selection simultaneously? Given the importance of post-selection in quantum information processing, due to this idea that I just mentioned of using measurement to actually create an effective nonlinearity, effective quantum logic gates, I think it becomes especially timely, no pun intended, to try to figure out how we can describe a system that's going to be post-selected. And you've heard a bit about various ways of doing this, both the ABL rule and weak measurement. I'm going to focus on the latter. And the idea, just to recap, is the following. We think of a system that's been prepared in some state I, but that at some point will be verified to be in a state F. And we'd like to know about properties of the systems in between those two times. And Copenhagenists teach us that we just shouldn't talk about that. We should only talk about what we measure. Well, we can at least ask what different ways are there to measure these properties. What would the properties of those measurements be? And my argument is that as long as there are some universal properties of broad classes of measurements, we should have the right to say that what we're describing is actual properties of that system at intermediate times. And of course, if you ask whether the values of A depend more on I or on F, the textbook answer seems to say, well, it just depends on I. And after the measurement, which is, of course, some uncontrollable, irreversible disturbance, all bets are off, and we just restart the clock and propagate to the future to F. even given that, obviously, we can go ahead and do statistics and say, well, all right, given each discovery of A, there's going to be a different probability distribution for F to succeed. And that's how one derives the ABL rule. But even beyond that, you can go straight to this idea of measuring weakly, trying to get rid of that uncontrollable disturbance, and saying if there is no such disturbance, if the coupling is sufficiently weak that it doesn't jar the system irreversibly, then we should have the complete time reversibility of the Schrödinger equation. And in fact, if you calculate sort of expectation value for what will happen to a pointer coupled to A, you find this weak value that you've already heard about that's nicely symmetric to within complex conjugation between the initial and final states. And the problem with it is that it has a lot of strange properties. So what I want to try to do in the next 45 minutes is tell you about some of the experimental implementations we've done of weak measurement on different systems and how, in some sense, they've really taught us a new way of looking at these systems, maybe helped resolve certain controversies, certain paradoxes, but at the same time raise new problems for which I don't have any answer to offer. I just want to point to the problems and let people yell at me or offer some solution to how we should think about them. So weak measurement goes back to looking at the standard von Neumann theory of measurement, which is to say that we have to couple our system to some pointer that we're going to read out at a later time. And if the measurement is to be any good, we want the pointer to be in a pretty well-defined state. Now, if we're going to describe the coupling, we should describe the whole thing quantum mechanically. So we will think of a quantum mechanical state for the pointer, but with a very narrow distribution, such that after the pointer interacts with the system through this Hamiltonian, which generates displacements for the pointer proportional to the value of the system observable A, we will end up with well-resolvable positions for the pointer depending on what state the system was in. And these dashed lines here are meant to indicate that the system and pointer have in fact become completely entangled. Every possible value of A for the system corresponds to a different position for the pointer. And it's in this sense that if we trace out the system, sorry, if we trace out the pointer at this stage, we end up with complete decoherence for the system. That, in a sense, is the large back action that we're getting. The idea of weak measurement just comes from imagining the same interaction Hamiltonian, but saying we need not get so much information on an individual trial. We can begin with a pointer state that's a very uncertain position in such a way that regardless of the value of A, the shift was small compared to the initial uncertainty in the pointer. And if you work through it, you find that instead of getting this entangled state of the system state and the different positions for the pointer, you can end up with something that's arbitrarily close to still being a product state of the undisturbed system wave function, and the pointer merely displaced by some amount, which is proportional to this weak value that I showed you before and that you've already heard about. One can also think about this in terms of the conjugate variables and argue that if you look at this Hamiltonian, you see that it's this Px, the pointer momentum, which generates the translations of the pointer. If the pointer is in a very well-defined state, Px must be very uncertain. So from the perspective of the system, I have a Hamiltonian with a large uncertain parameter in it. And this is the origin of the noise as experienced by the system. In the case where I have a large uncertainty in the pointer position, it's possible for me to have a small uncertainty in the pointer momentum, and therefore pretty close to unitary evolution for the system. I can get rid of that disturbance. I want to show you an alternate derivation of weak values. Maybe derivation is too strong a term because I can't justify the steps. But I always show this to people because I think it's somehow very telling that this has such a nice structure. That if you just apply probability theory to quantum mechanics, the weak value actually falls out directly without having to calculate what happens with any specific measurement. So the idea is the following. If we want to know the value of some observable, what do we really mean? Well, we just mean the average over its eigenvalues weighted by the probabilities. What do I mean by a conditional value or a weak value? I mean, instead of asking what's the probability of eigenvalue j, I want to know what's the probability of eigenvalue j given that I prepared in I and post-selected in F. I just need to know these conditional probabilities. And we know, thanks to Bayes' theorem, how to calculate conditional probabilities. We simply take the joint probability, P of A and B, divide by P of B, and we have P of A given B. All we have to do then is plug this into quantum mechanics, and the problem is, how do we express these probabilities? Well, P of A or P of B is simple. It's just the expectation value of the projector onto the given state, which has eigenvalues 0 and 1, of course. And you see there that written out and expanded into the more familiar form. The question is, what do you do with P of A and B? Well, since these are probabilities, and since they're projectors with eigenvalues 0 and 1, it seems natural to refer to the joint probability as the eigenvalue of the product of the two projectors. And I've put them in a time-ordered notation here, which means now that P of A and B can just be written as this funny matrix element over here. And if we just plug that definition for a joint probability into the expression for P of a given eigenvalue of A given the post-selection, we see that we have an expectation value of this product of projectors on top and of a single projector on bottom. And if we work through, we see that we're going to end up, when we take the inner product, with an inner product of initial and final states both on top and on bottom, which cancel out, leaving us exactly the weak value. So this is not the original derivation of weak values, right? The original derivation actually showed if you couple to a pointer, use the standard approach to quantum mechanics, no extra assumptions, and see how large is the displacement of the pointer, it will be proportional to this value. But it's the same that you get if you just think about the system itself and ask, how would I calculate these conditional probabilities? So I think that's one additional piece of evidence pointing to the idea that weak values really do tell us something about the system itself, not just about specific measurements. Now, how did I get interested in all of this? I mentioned that I was working on tunneling times while I was at Berkeley. Aharonov actually came and visited for a while. He gave the most fascinatingly structured series of lectures I think I've heard in my life. He was going to give a series of, I don't know, 4 or 5 lectures. After the first one, someone took him aside and explained that no one in the room had understood anything. So for the second lecture, he went over the first half of his first talk more slowly, and still no one understood anything. So for the third lecture, he went off the first half of the first half of the first talk. And by the end of the fourth talk, I understood 2^-4 of the first talk, I think. And several years later, was able to put it together and actually apply it to something. We were working on trying to figure out how long a particle takes to traverse a barrier, which I think you also heard about a little bit yesterday, a problem that's been controversial since roughly 1932, 5 years after tunneling was first mentioned. And the question here is, if we prepare an initial state, and it's incident on some rectangular barrier, and at some later time we find that the particle has been transmitted, what can we say about where it was while it was traversing the barrier, or how long it spent under the barrier? You see, if I didn't make this post-selection, I could say, well, the probability distribution for the particle was always given by psi squared. And we've all seen these movies of what happens. We have that in any textbook. But do we get extra information from telling that the particle was transmitted as opposed to being reflected? And weak values are one way to address this. The probability of X can just be written as the expectation value of the projector onto X. We can go through all of the math that I was mentioning before. And it gives us this nice, simple, symmetric expression. That's just exactly the weak value expression rewritten for position wave functions. Now, there's one problem, and people have pointed this out both in connection with weak values and in connection with some other proposals for tunneling times based, for instance, on Feynman integrals, which is that you get complex values. If you just work out the tunneling time, by which I mean the integral over all time of the probability for the particle to be somewhere in the barrier at that time, you find the combination of two other parameters that were known from other calculations, but a complex combination. And Butiker and Landauer rather famously asked, has anyone ever seen a stopwatch with complex numbers on the dial? And I reproduce that quote precisely because I think it's the wrong question to ask. We could put complex numbers on the dial. It wouldn't actually help us. The point is, the thing we're measuring does not represent what's on the dial. It represents a parameter that shows up in the wave function for the pointer, the dial in this case. So if you imagine a pointer is being described by some Gaussian wave packet, the idea is that the time we're measuring, or some quantity proportional to that, is going to show up as the new center of the Gaussian wave packet. Sorry, I should be pointing at the top line there, top green line. If that parameter is complex, all that means is that the real part tells us about a shift of the position of the pointer, precisely what we expected to see. And the imaginary part shows up as a momentum shift. So somehow, when you have a complex value for a measurement result, it means that not only do you get a pointer shift, but there's also a shift in the conjugate variable to pointer position. And this, in my opinion, is simply related to quantum mechanical back action. We have measurements that disturb the system, and the pointer is itself disturbed in momentum. And I'll show you some examples of exactly how that happens. The interesting thing about this interpretation is it takes times that people had already been discussing in the tunneling time community, and it puts them on sort of a clear logical footing. We now understand what the significance of each of these quantities is. We don't have to argue about whether the tunneling time is the real part or the imaginary part or the magnitude. We know exactly what they would do to any measuring device that we let it interact with. And a famous example is the Larmor clock, based on ideas by Bass and Rybachenko, and later sort of corrected by Butiker. And the idea is very simple. This is a nice example of a real quantum clock. If you want to know how long a transmitted electron, let's say, spent in a square barrier, one thing you might do is begin with spin-polarized electrons, spin along the x direction here. Confine a magnetic field along the z direction inside the barrier region, and then reason that as long as the electron is inside the barrier, its spin is going to be precessing at a well-known Larmor frequency around the z axis. If we then look at the transmitted particle, all we have to do is measure how far has the spin precessed. And we know how long it's spent in the barrier. And one of the reasons this time disturbs people is that if you calculate it for a thick barrier, you can find that it may be much smaller than the width of the barrier divided by the vacuum velocity of light. And this is actually one of the reasons tunneling time has remained a controversial issue. Many of the times that we calculate have that property. In fact, if you just use stationary phase to calculate when the peak of a wave packet would appear on the far side of the barrier, you also find that it can seem to do so faster than light. And the question is, should we just accept that? Or should we follow people like Butiker and say, all right, wave packets, peaks of wave packets are really sort of motion of effects. They don't tell us anything about physical reality. There should be some actual interaction time that might be different and might seem more in accord with our relativistic intuitions. So Butiker came back to this. And of course, the idea is with any measurement was to lower the magnetic field sufficiently that it didn't really disturb the tunneling process too much. Obviously, every measurement disturbs the system. But if you made B small enough, they argued, you didn't have to worry about it changing the transmission characteristics. This could be a small angle. You'd take the limit as B goes to zero of the ratio of that angle to the precession rate. However, Butiker pointed out that if you have this spin along x, you can decompose it as spin up and spin down. The spin up being aligned with the field has a lower energy in the barrier than the spin down. And since the transmission across the tunnel barrier is exponentially sensitive to that energy, the spin up will be preferentially transmitted. So the full effect is that not only is there a precession, there's also a tendency of the spin to align with the magnetic field. Now, of course, this was known, this was obvious, but the implicit assumption in the earlier work had been that as B goes to zero, you can neglect this effect. And what Butiker found is, in fact, you can't. These effects both come into the same order in B, and the alignment effect tends to be larger than the precession effect. So what we were left with is the precession angle and a second angle, the alignment angle, or then the quadrature sum of the two, which Butiker decided was the entire angle and liked to associate with the full traversal time. But you see, it's sort of an arbitrary choice now. Which of these angles do you use? If you go to weak measurement, that precession angle, the pointer shift I expected, is the real value, the real part of the weak value for the tunneling time. The alignment angle is related to the imaginary part. Now, instead of just integrating and looking at times, we can make these movies again. We can ask, what is the probability of a particle being at x at a given time, given that I post-select that it will eventually be transmitted? And what you see is that at early times, it's simply a Gaussian wave packet approaching a barrier. It begins to experience some self-interference. But as time gets later and later, what you discover is that more and more of the particle is transmitted. And oddly, it experiences self-interference on the transmitted side, which is not true for the full psi squared. But most interestingly, it never spends time right in the middle of the barrier, or more strictly, the probability to be in the middle of the barrier is exponentially suppressed. The interesting thing is that you see an exponential decay on the left-hand side. As we know, the probability of finding a particle deeper and deeper in the barrier is exponentially low. But you find an exponential growth on the right-hand side. In some sense, we're saying, I know the particle spent some time on the left because that's where I sent it in. But if it's transmitted, I also know that it spent some time on the right because that's where I eventually found it. So indeed, we get some information from the preparation and some information from the post-selection. However, we don't really resolve the problem of how much time it takes to go across. It still seems that it skipped most of the middle of the barrier, in some sense explaining why it seems to traverse in a time less than d over c. Now, if you look carefully, there are some thick dashed lines, and you'll notice those aren't zero in the center of the barrier. Those relate to the imaginary part of the time. So what this is saying is if I look for a shift on the pointer, I ask, how much will my particle affect a measuring device? I find essentially not at all in the middle of the barrier, even if it's transmitted. But if I ask the reverse question, how much back action is there by the measuring device on the particle, I find that's largest right inside the tunneling region. So there is, in fact, a large imaginary component to this time. Butiker and Landauer thought that that large imaginary component solved the tunneling time problem because it doesn't have this causality issue with it. It turns out that depends on the limit. There are regions where both of these times can be less than d over c. So if you're just trying to solve that problem, we still haven't done so. Don't worry about it. What would this mean practically? Well, I showed you the Larmor clock, but I'd like a more local clock. So a Gedanken experiment I like to think about is imagining a proton tunneling along one direction, somehow constrained to be along one direction. And I measure the probability that it's at different places by using test charges. So I have a series of conducting sheets that shield out different regions. And far away from the proton, I place a bunch of electrons at rest. After the tunneling event is completed, what I'll see is that the momentum of each of these electrons has changed by an amount that's proportional to how long it saw the Coulomb field of the corresponding proton. And of course, if I work that out, I expect to see some exponential decay. The electron closest to the entrance of this tunnel barrier will have seen the proton the longest, or will have had the highest probability to see it, and it'll have the largest momentum shift. And the prediction from weak measurement is that if I post-select only transmitted protons, and I ask what is the average momentum shift for the electron when the proton is transmitted, I'll see something completely symmetric. I'll see a large momentum shift for the first electrons and also for the last electrons, but essentially no momentum shift for the electrons in the middle, as though they had never seen the proton. What's the significance of the imaginary time? Well, remember, the imaginary time is telling us about the conjugate pointer variable. Here it gets a little convoluted because you notice it's the electron momentum that's the pointer position. So what does that mean? It means that the pointer momentum is the electron position. So the imaginary part tells me that not the momentum, but the position of all of these electron wave packets will be shifted when I post-select a transmitted proton. Why is that? Well, that's actually very simple to understand. Depending on the position of the electron, which was, of course, quantum mechanically uncertain in these wave packets, the proton, as it tunnels here, experiences a different potential. If the electron happened to be a little closer to the proton experienced somewhat lower potential and was therefore more likely to tunnel. When I do this post-selection, I'm selecting out those cases where it was more likely to tunnel. So it really is the back action plus that post-selection that gives me the shift in the conjugate variable. Right, the Hamiltonian itself cannot shift instantaneously the position of these electrons, but the post-selection can do so. Now, this got me thinking a lot about locality, because since we know that the wave packet peaks come out faster than the speed of light, it seemed one could draw the following kind of space-time diagram, where time is increasing upwards here. I have some incident pulse, some wave packet, incident on a barrier, the peak of the transmitted wave packet, much smaller wave packet, but its peak is going to be emitted at some point that's space-like separated from that. And in fact, if the delay is small enough relative to d over c, I could imagine choosing regions that are entirely space-like separated from one another, and that each contain an arbitrarily large fraction of these Gaussian wave packets. And in some sense, since the particle never spent any time in between, I could say, well, it was certain to be in this region and certain to be in this region. And I want to ask myself, can a quantum particle actually be certainly in two space-like separated regions? Could I do an experiment where I have a measuring device coupled to this region, another one coupled to this region, and at least on the occasions when I detect a transmitted particle, I would find that both measuring devices had been affected by the same particle. Now, I don't know, this, the answer may be obvious to many of you, although probably different answers are obvious to different ones of you. First of all, I want to make it clear there's no contradiction here. I'm not saying that information can be transmitted between two space-like separated points. I'm saying that one cause can have two effects, can affect two different detectors, which are space-like separated. That's not surprising. You can put a radio antenna somewhere, and simultaneously people on opposite sides of the radio antenna can listen to the same broadcast. The question is whether a single particle can do that. Are quantum particles actually local in that sense? Or can a single electron, a single photon, simultaneously affect two different receivers? Now, when I talk about this with people, many tell me, I don't understand why you're going on about this. We all know that a particle can go through both arms of a two-slit interferometer simultaneously. And I would argue that this is really a different case. Here, I'm not asking whether the particle can simultaneously be 50% at the left slit and 50% at the right slit. I'm asking whether it can be 100% at the left slit and 100% at the right slit. And I think it's a different question and would be a much deeper sort of non-locality. So in terms of how to address it, what we had in mind, not that we actually know how to do this experiment, is to place two detectors here and here, or in a two-slit or a Mach-Zehnder interferometer, two detectors in the different arms, and say, all right, we know that each detector is going to shift by an amount small compared to its uncertainty. That's the hypothesis of weak measurement. But we can still look at correlations, event by event, between these two. And if, in each case, only one of these detectors could really be affected by the particle, we would expect that the distribution of D1 minus D2 would get broader, because on any individual event, either D1 is shifting or D2 is shifting. Whereas if, in fact, both detectors are always being affected by the particle, we might expect that D1 by minus D2 is not broadened, that there's no correlation, no anti-correlation between those two events. So this is a question that we posed here, and since we haven't done the experiment, I won't tell you the answer right now, but if anyone wants to chime in at some point and tell me what the answer has to be, I'd be curious. We're actually planning an experiment on this. One way you can imagine the experiment is to make a Bose condensate, typically confined in a harmonic trap, turn off the trap, let the particle start falling under the influence of gravity. That's the way we're doing it right now. And then make a barrier for the particle. Turns out you can make barriers for atoms just by focusing laser beams that are detuned properly from the atomic resonance. So at some point, the atom collides with this laser beam, and magic happens. And on the other side, here be dragons. We will try to measure the state of the atom after it's been transmitted through this barrier. And we should be able to combine this with all sorts of different ways of probing the time, including an equivalent of that Larmor time and various other proposals that have been out there. Now, in fact, we're more likely to do it differently. It turns out this is rather an uncontrolled geometry. So we've now set up a horizontal trap so that we can confine the atoms in the horizontal direction, hold them still, and simply slide the barrier across the atoms if the mountain can't come to Muhammad. And although, as I said, we're not doing that experiment yet, just to prove that we are experimentalists, I needed to put up some data. This is how far we've gotten. We're looking at interactions of Bose-condensed atoms with barriers, not currently at tunneling. The barrier isn't quite thin enough, although it's close. But what we've seen here are effects related to the extreme sharpness of a barrier. These are actually interference patterns. The atoms are interfering with themselves in momentum space after colliding with a time-dependent barrier. But I won't talk more about that for now. Instead, let me leave behind the questions of tunneling and show you some perhaps easier to grasp applications of weak measurement that we've carried out in the laboratory. The first one, again, I think Lev might have been talking about. This is the three-box problem. And it's something that I usually use to skeptical audiences to convince them that they shouldn't take too much of Copenhagen on faith. And we can, in fact, sometimes talk about things we haven't directly measured. The simple example is the following. I give you three boxes, and I tell you, all right, I put a particle in either A or B. And at some time later, I look for the particle, and I find it in either B or C. Well, quantum mechanically, I prepare the particles in a superposition A plus B, and later on, I find them in a superposition B plus C. And I ask you, where was the particle at intermediate times? And I don't know how theorists think, but to an experimentalist, it's rather obvious that the particle must have been in B. If it had been in C, it would be inconsistent with the preparation. If it had been in A, I would never have found it in that post-selection. So I don't think many people really dispute this one. The problem quantum mechanically is, what do we really mean by a box? All we mean is some distinct state. We mean some set of orthogonal states. So there's nothing wrong with, instead of talking about box A and box C, I talk about a box that's a superposition, x plus y, of two other boxes, and a different state that's the orthogonal superposition, x minus y, of two other boxes. In other words, I'll replace that A plus B with x plus B plus y. Here the physical boxes are x, b, and y. And I'll replace the B plus C with x plus B minus y. And once more, if logic hasn't changed, I'll conclude that the particle must have been in box B with certainty. The problem is, this is not a unique decomposition. If I can make that argument, why can't I do a different replacement and say, where do I have the definition of B prime? I think I lost it. I can take this x plus B plus y and say, let me call that x plus B prime, where B prime is defined to be B plus y. Let me take this x plus B minus y and define that to be x plus C prime, where C prime is now B minus y. Well, B prime and C prime are orthogonal. So once more, if I prepared an x plus B prime and I found it x plus C prime, it must have been in x, which is this first box. So the same reasoning that I used to prove that it was in the second box, I can use in exactly the same situation to prove that it was in the first box. So it seems like the particle is definitely in the first box and definitely in the second box. And in the case of the Gedanken experiment, again, you can imagine a charged particle in one of these boxes and put a test particle out here that would pick up a certain momentum if it saw the particle, and now shield off the different boxes and say, well, if I do that post-selection, I'll find that even if my test particle only sees box A, it will pick up the same momentum kick that it would have if it saw all three boxes, certain to be looking at the particle. On the other hand, if it looked only at the second box, I conclude it would also have picked up that same momentum shift, which is rather strange. And since electromagnetic fields can be superposed, I have to conclude that if it had been looking at the third box, it would pick up the opposite momentum shift. So when I add these three, I get the full momentum shift corresponding to a particle definitely being somewhere. So it's this bottom result that's very strange, and that relates to the possibility of a negative value for the weak probability, or the weak value. So I don't know if you've seen the calculation, but if we go back to this formula, and for the observables, we simply put in the probabilities to be in box A, B, or C. We prepare an A plus B plus C. We post-select an A plus B minus C. The overlap of these two states is 1/3. And if we sandwich between these, the projectors, we find minus 1/3 for the C case because of that minus sign, plus 1/3 for the other two. Indeed, we find the weak valued probability to be in box A is 1, to be in box B is 1, and to be in box C is minus 1. So these are two of the big puzzles about weak values. As much as I like them, I don't really know what a negative probability means. I don't know what a complex probability or a complex time means, except operationally. The nice thing is you can just tell me I'm stupid to be using these words. If I just talked about the measuring devices, there would be no problem. And that's true. I've shown you on the previous slide what it would really mean operationally for a measuring device. So can this be observed? And I should mention there's also an extension to an arbitrary number of boxes, or slits in this case. And it was shown that you could actually use post-selection to guarantee that a particle would be blocked by a single shutter, even if that particle was being sent to an arbitrary superposition of different positions. So experimentally, how do we do this? Well, our three boxes are simply three arms of an interferometer. Our particle is a photon. We take an ensemble of photons, truly just a classical light source in this case, and we prepare them in a superposition of these three paths. That's what every interferometer does. And then if we see them come out a given output port, we're post-selecting them in a given superposition of those three paths. If we want to change A plus B plus C to A plus B minus C for the post-selection, we simply put in a half wave plate here, an element that gives us an extra pi phase shift in that path. Now all we have to do is, on the cases where the photon is transmitted, somehow measure the probability to have been in each of these three paths. And for that, we use a trick originally due to Ricci, Story, and Hewlett, who used the external degree of freedom, the transverse position of the photon, as a clock that the photon itself carries with it. since the photon isn't going to interact with anything else until I detect it, the clock has to be internal to the photon itself. But I wasn't using the transverse position of the photon for anything. So we're free to do that. What we do is we have a photon in some Gaussian mode, some wave packet, and we let it travel through a tilted piece of glass, which just displaces the position of the beam. In other words, it displaces the mean position of the photon, but by an amount that's small compared to the uncertainty in the photon position. So we can put this piece of glass in any one of those three arms and thereby measure the weak probability for the particle to have been in that path just by looking at the physical displacement of the beam that's transmitted. And what you find here, if we map out the photon positions or the intensity distribution in that post-selected port, what you find is here are the cases with no shift. If I only let path A or path B travel through, I find no probability to have been in path C. In other words, if I block path C, it doesn't matter how I tilt the piece of glass in there. On the other hand, if I only let path C travel through, I see a shift in this direction. That's just the direction I tilted the glass in. So that's a calibration measurement. But if I look at this proper post-selected output, I find that the distribution shifts in the opposite direction. Even though all I've done is I've placed a piece of glass that should shift photons to the right, if I do the correct post-selection, I find the typical photon is shifted to the left. And that's the meaning of the negative weak value. Now, of course, this is a classical interference experiment, so it's not hard to understand. One could write down all of the optics for it and see that we just have interference between a few different beams. The interference very naturally shifts the peak in this direction. And fundamentally, that's all weak measurement is. It's all quantum mechanics is interference. On the other hand, when we go beyond a single particle, I think you'll see that it gets a little more complicated. So we've been able to go through and vary the strength of that interaction, the strength of the von Neumann interaction, by changing the tilt of the glass. And what you find is, as long as the displacement is small compared to the original uncertainty in photon position, you see a positive slope here that indicates a probability of 1 to be in either rail A or rail B, given the post-selection. But a negative slope here that gives you a probability of -1 to be in box C, given that same post-selection. And as soon as the shift is too large, you see this all breaks down, and we get things that look a little more reasonable by classical intuitions. Now, the real reason I was interested in this is to come back to that tunneling question. If the particle is definitely in box A and definitely in box B, can I say that it was really in both places at the same time? Do I have this strong non-locality, or at least non-corpuscularity, for these photons? The problem is, what I want to do now is measure the joint probability to be in A and B. And we don't have the kind of non-local interaction that you might want to do that. So as I alluded to earlier, we're going to look at correlations. We're going to ask, when pointers for A and B move, do they always move together, the uncertainty in their difference never growing? Or does only one of them move at a time so that the uncertainty in their difference will increase? And we showed theoretically that you really could extract the weak value of a joint observable just by coupling two different pointers that I'll call X and Y, measuring the correlations between those pointers and using the following expression. But it's just the mathematical instantification of the intuition that I already gave you about the growth and the uncertainty. The T squared is simply because the total size of the interaction is GA times T. T represents the duration of the interaction. But you can get rid of the time dependence. We just happen to write it in sort of Schrodinger form. So the data, I want to be careful to say these were non-repeatable. This was the set that worked nicely. We never published it because A, the error bars were very large anyway, and B, as I say, we couldn't always get quite this. But this is a measure of the correlations between the pointers that are coupled to box A and box B. And here are some models. If there were no correlations, we would expect this uncertainty never to grow. If we had perfectly anti-correlated particles, we would get these 45-degree lines, these dashed lines. And if you just work out what actually should happen according to optics, you get these curved shapes here. And from this, you can extract the probability of jointly being in the first box and the second box. And the problem, as you see, is it's consistent with zero everywhere, showing that you seem to never be in both boxes simultaneously. But in the regime here, where the measurement was really weak, the error bars are huge. So there are a few points here that I might trust. I don't want to push it too far, especially since, I'll skip that for now, we didn't need to go through that. The thing I wanted to measure is the joint probability could be an A and B, and I told you the joint probability is constructed by taking the product of these two projection operators. But A and B are two orthogonal states. The inner product of A and B is zero. So in fact, this operator I want to measure weakly is identically zero anyway. We don't need to do an experiment to show that the particle can never be found in two orthogonal states simultaneously. So we're in the funny situation where the particle is definitely in A and definitely in B, but it certainly isn't in A and B. And if that sounds like a contradiction, you should be careful. We don't have a product rule for probabilities, right? Product rule for probabilities only works when things are uncorrelated. Nevertheless, we think that if two things are certain, that means that their union is also certain. But that relies on an assumption. And the assumption is that probabilities are bounded by 0 and 1. Thanks. If you take out that assumption, you find that we can fill in this sort of truth table very easily. The probability to be in B is 1. The probability to be in A is 1. The probability to be in A and B, however, is 0. And that's simply because the probability to be in B and not A is 1. A and not B is 1. And the minus 1 over here to be in box C, i.e. not A and not B, is minus 1. And weak values give you these negative valued probabilities. So, all right, we might worry about negative valued probabilities, but the interesting thing is they basically preserve all the rest of the structure of probabilities if you just allow that. And allowing that one thing removes a lot of other things that could be problems. So let me move to something that really could be a problem. This is quantum seeing in the dark. I still just like to think of this as Lev's bomb problem, although people have taken a more politically correct descriptions of it, interaction-free measurement, or as I said, quantum seeing in the dark. And the original proposal is very simple. Consider that I have a collection of extremely sensitive bombs, so sensitive that interaction with any given particle is guaranteed to set them off. And then the supplier of these bombs tells me, oh, I'm sorry, in the previous shipment, a bunch of the bombs were defective. Half of them have defective triggers and will never explode no matter what you do. And they said, don't worry about it, though. Just return the defective bombs and we'll be happy to replace them. And I say, okay, can you tell me which ones are defective? And they sort of scratch their heads and say, well, you know, they're bombs. We figured you'd be blowing them up. We didn't print serial numbers on them or anything like that. We didn't think that was going to matter to you. So, well, you know, all right, are the defective detectors triggers a little lighter than the others, or are they a different color, or is there anything different? No, the only physical difference, I'm afraid, is that the defective ones will not trigger and those bombs will not blow up. So, of course, the only way to test whether the bomb is defective or not is to try to blow it up. But then, if it wasn't defective, you've blown it up and you've lost the bomb. Is there any way to tell whether a bomb is defective or not without exploding it? And what Elitzur and Weidman showed is, in fact, there is a way in quantum mechanics, even though it's rather obvious classically, that it couldn't be. And the way is to set up yet another interferometer, an interferometer where, let's say, a single photon comes into this beam splitter, can take either of two paths. But if the phases are aligned properly, there's always going to be constructive interference at this port and destructive interference at port D. Port D is referred to as the dark port. The detector there never fires. Now, what happens if there's a bomb in the way, such that when the particle takes this path, the bomb will explode? Well, then, of course, we have which path information. There won't be any interference. First of all, if the bomb explodes, we won't be in the lab to discuss this anymore anyway. So if the bomb doesn't explode, we know that the particle took this path. And there's nothing left for it to interfere with. It's got a 50-50 chance of going either way at the beam splitter, which means that one quarter of the time, the bomb will not explode, and the photon will hit detector D, which, however, never fired when I didn't have a functioning bomb here, when there was no which path information. So what that means is that one quarter of the time, I'll see detector D fire, and I'll be able to say, oh, there must be a working bomb here, even though I know that the photon didn't go that way because the bomb didn't blow up. So for all the people who think that quantum mechanics shows us that trees falling in forests without observers don't make sounds, here I'd say almost the reverse. I'd say quantum mechanics isn't even a theory of what happens. Quantum mechanics is a theory of everything which could have happened. Quantum mechanics depends on what would have happened if the photon had gone the other way. Now, the idea that the photon didn't interact with the particle is problematic, because if we've measured a particle, we know we've disturbed it. And a lot of people worried about this, including Lev and Avshalom, and also including Lucien Hardy, who came up with what I think was the natural way to try to address the problem. If I could really measure whether or not the bomb was here, then at the very least I must have decohered the state of the bomb. So why not suppose that the bomb itself is a quantum particle and study its coherence? Well, how do you do that? You, for instance, make your test particle a positron and the bomb an electron, and you have them overlap in some region W. And we hypothesize that this is set up in such a way that if the electron and positron meet in W, they're guaranteed to annihilate. But now the electron used to be in a superposition of being in W and not being in W. If, on the other hand, my positron reaches detector D plus, telling me that the electron was in fact in, then I know where the electron is. By carrying out this measurement, I must at least decohere these two arms. Well, how would I test that? Obviously, I would close this interferometer, and the symmetry has already leapt out at all of you. I would now say, how do I know that it's a positron making an interaction-free measurement of an electron and not the other way around? And if you think about this a little more, you realize there are some interesting consequences. If D plus fires, I know that the electron must have been in W. But if D minus fires, I know that the positron must have been in W. So if D plus and D minus fire, both particles were in W, but I assumed that if both particles were in W, they were going to annihilate, which means that D plus and D minus could never have fired. Therefore, D plus and D minus cannot fire, but they do. If you work out the quantum mechanics, Lucien showed there was one chance in 16 of D plus and D minus firing. So this seems to be a problem with the whole program of retrodiction, or at least with the application of interaction-free measurements, to really talking about where the particles were. And there is a solution to this problem, but of course, I want to tell you how we do the experiments. When Lucien first came up with this, we were all very thrilled by the paper and wanted to figure out how to do the experiment, figuring that no one was actually going to build these overlapping electron and positron interferometers, and didn't he know that we should just do it with photons? Of course, a moment's thought reminded us that photons don't interact with each other, basically, so that we couldn't make that bomb very easily. And we recently came up with a way to make the bomb. And I wouldn't normally go into such an experimental technical digression, but it actually has to do with time, so I thought it would be interesting. The way that we do experiments with single photons and with entangled photons, everyone around the world does this, is by using a process known as spontaneous parametric downconversion. It's simply a process where a photon of a high frequency hits a certain nonlinear crystal, and two lower frequency photons come out in its place. And whenever anyone gives a talk on this, they explain, those of you who know anything about optics know about some frequency generation. Those of you who play your stereos too loud know about other harmonics that you get from nonlinear behavior. And the time reverse of some frequency generation, where two red photons make a blue, is down conversion, where one blue photon turns into a red. And it's a purely spontaneous, non-classical process. I repeated this conventional wisdom in all of my talks for probably more than a decade, before one day I stopped myself and said, wait, I've just claimed that what I'm doing is the time reverse of a very familiar classical nonlinear optical process, and that it only exists in quantum mechanics. And yet I know that classical electromagnetism is time reversible. So we've all been lying to each other for years. The time reverse of any classical process is also a classical process. If spontaneous down conversion is a purely quantum process, it must be the time reverse of some other purely quantum process. And in fact, here's the problem. This is what spontaneous parametric down conversion really looks like. It looks like a lot of blue photons coming into a crystal, and with probability of 1 minus 10 to the minus 10, simply sailing through the crystal without doing anything, and a very small probability amplitude for a photon pair to be generated. The time reverse would be the case where not only did I have two photons coming in, but I also had a strong pump simultaneously. And coming out this way, I would get the second harmonic, but all of the red light would disappear. Turns out that's classically impossible. You can't get rid of all of the red light in this classical process. Quantum mechanically, you can. So this is my switch. Even though fundamentally both of these processes, up conversion and down conversion, typically have an efficiency on the order of 1 in 10 billion, if I add the strong pump and just the right phases, I can generate the time reverse of SPDC, which is a case where these two photons are guaranteed to annihilate. They don't annihilate, they turn into a blue photon. But for all practical purposes, they've annihilated. So here's a way to think of that in terms of quantum interference. I send three beams into this crystal. Two of them are laser beams that may or may not contain photons. One of them is a strong pump beam. If I look for pairs of photons out here, there are two different indistinguishable ways I could get a photon pair. I could have a down conversion event, blue turning into two reds. or I could just have two laser photons that have to sail through the crystal. If I adjust the phases right, these two processes will interfere destructively. I will never see pairs here. And any photons that existed, any photon pairs that existed in the laser beams, will simply upconvert. And it works experimentally. It can be used as a switch. More importantly, we can make Hardy's pair of interferometers this way. So this is the experimental layout for the Hardy paradox experiment. What we've done is we've folded these two interferometers on top of each other. We've let the positron be played by a horizontally polarized photon, the electron by a vertically polarized photon. We've let them be created in a down-conversion crystal, and then have the option of sailing back through that crystal, where if they both take the same path, they will be upconverted, effectively destroyed. So what happens? We pump this crystal. Two photons are emitted. They go up this way. Here's the first beam splitter in the interferometer. Each photon can either be transmitted or reflected. If they're both reflected, they both go back through this crystal, and they can therefore annihilate. But if at least one of them is transmitted, then there's no way for them to annihilate here. We close the interferometer. We measure what happens. That's what it looks like in practice. And what do we expect to happen? Well, it's very much like the three-box problem. We know that the positron was in if we see both dark detectors fire. We know the electron was in if we see both dark detectors fire. But we know that they couldn't both have been in, or we wouldn't have seen any photons at all. So we play Sudoku. We find out that, once more, the probability for one to be in and the other to be out was 100%, whichever is one and whichever is the other. But there's a minus one weak valued probability for them both to be out. And in fact, if you go through the weak measurement formalism, that's exactly what you find, as was shown in this paper here. But again, it looked like you'd need some strange non-local interaction to measure the joint probability that the positron was over here and the electron was over here. So we played the same trick we did for the three-box problem, and we showed experimentally, based on these weak values, that the probability was close to zero for both to be in. Not exactly zero because the experiment isn't perfect. Large for one to be in and the other out. Large for the other to be in and the other out. And notice the sum is greater than one. And large and negative for both to be out. So there really are experimental consequences of these things. This paper should appear on the archive soon. And I won't show you the final stuff. It's due to Howard Wiseman anyway, so ask him about it. But I'll say that one more controversy that we're able to, in a sense, resolve is the controversy over which path measurement and whether or not complementarity needs to be enforced by the uncertainty principle, or whether it's possible for which path measurements to destroy interference without disturbing the momentum. And it turns out that both can be true. We did an experiment doing weak measurements to show this. Anyone who wants to talk about it privately, I'll happily tell you what we actually did. But for now, let me just sort of tell you the moral of the story from my perspective. Post-selected systems are very important. They exhibit a lot of surprising features. And weak measurement gives us a way of probing this and really starting to understand, I think, how we should talk about what the system was doing before the post-selection. It raises other questions. I don't know exactly how to talk about it. I should probably just stop using the word probability, but then no one will get confused. I think we need some confusion at this stage. I think using these weak measurements helps us understand certain things, resolve certain paradoxes, but gives us the other problems. And in particular, both in the Welcher-Weg or which path controversy and in Hardy's paradox, we can basically satisfy all of the claims of the paradoxes and yet say there is no contradiction if you allow to think of these probabilities in a weak sense. In other words, if you allow negative probabilities. And a post-selected particle may be certain to have been in each of two paths at the same time, yet it can never be in both at the same time. And experimentally, we are continuing towards those tunneling time experiments. We're also working on another proposal based on an idea of Howard's to measure the Bohmian trajectories of particles in a two-slit interferometer using weak measurement. So hopefully one day I'll get to tell you about that as well. Thank you for your attention.
Thanks, Ephraim. We'll have time for just a few quick questions before lunch.
This won't be a question. It'll be a correction. So.
I'm against confusion. So when you have a situation, then a projection operator equals 0.7, then you make a measurement and you find that the probability to find the particle there is 0.7. Now, what you really measure in all physics is about variables. So if you if you transform Bibcom probability projection operator, then no contradiction, it does have negative, maybe even complex values, no problem. Don't use probability. Probability, negative probability doesn't make any sense and bring only confusion.
And if I said density, particle density, density? Charge density?
It's okay. It's like projection. Yeah, no problem.
Okay.
No probability.
Negative density. That's better than what Yakir suggested, which is a positive probability of a negative particle. He confused me even more than I confused myself.
This is a pretty simple question. My son, I guess last year we were talking about interference and diffraction, and a couple years ago he did a science fair project with the laser beam through a little slit, and he saw all the little bands. So then I tried to explain to him that if you threw a basketball through a hole, on the other side, you would just get a pile of basketballs. You wouldn't get that interference pattern. And he quickly pointed out to me, he went to Google, and he Googled sand dunes. And he showed me some examples of sand dunes with interference patterns, where you would find two rocks in the middle of the sand, and on the other side, you would find interference patterns. He said, well, there you go, Dad. Sand is going through those two rocks, and there's interference patterns. So maybe it's not like one basketball going through, but when you send a lot of sand through, they actually interfere individually. And I guess the whole idea was that if you watched it go progress slowly as a time-lapse photography, you would see the sand being deposited only in those designated spots. Okay, I have no idea how to explain that.
I won't believe that in that case the sand particles themselves are interfering, but obviously there is interference of classical waves, and water waves and everything else. And one should properly say that in those cases, as Dirac says, it's every individual particle interfering with itself. I have no problem with that. Yes. Well, in some sense, this is certainly what the Bohm theory says, right? That the pilot wave goes through both slits, but the particle need only go through one. Certainly a possible explanation of this.
Any more questions? One more?
Hi, my name's Nick. I just wanted to point something out. I mean, the talk, I really enjoyed the talk, but I noticed that we've been talking about, you know, does the particle actually go through these various things?
Sorry, I've been talking about
whether the particle actually is in a box. I mean, these questions are of a realistic bias, and it seems that if you reinterpret this in terms of you know, the wave function representing information flow or what you, you know, from a Bayesian perspective, what you know about a system, then there's no contradictions in terms of, you know, if the wave packet starts to appear on the other side faster than it should via light transfer, then that's not a contradiction, because it just means that you know that it could, if you did a measurement over there, it would be there by now. So, I mean, I don't know. I guess it's more of a comment, and I wondered if you had anything to say about
I think it's a good comment. I certainly use realist language, which is unnecessary for describing this, right? There's a very clear physical meaning to these equations, and you can use them within whatever interpretation you like. In fact, I think the first time I tried to publish a paper on this stuff, I got a referee report back saying it's unclear what the author means by the word is. It was the first time I'd ever gotten a criticism like that. And of course, you know, I shouldn't say is, right? This theory doesn't talk about where the particle is. It talks about what shift I would see for a pointer if I coupled the pointer to the system in a certain way. Now, as something of a realist, I think that if any reasonable coupling to any reasonable measuring device would yield the same result, then it's maybe reasonable to attribute that reality to the particle itself. I'm not a philosopher. I won't try to defend this, and I know that one can argue it. But it's not necessary, right? It's not a fault in the theory. It's just a fault in my language if you disagree with it. You certainly can't get around it. But then there are experimentally real questions. You can still ask, if I had these two detectors looking at the particle at space-like separated positions, would there be anti-correlations between the shifts of those two detectors or not? And that question is independent of any choice of a realist or other interpretation of physics.
Let's thank Ephraim again.